This is tape 2, side 2, Century of Light, continuing from page 51. Deliberation on this vast conception was to lead Shoghi Effendi to provide the Baha'i world with a coherent description of the future that has since permitted three generations of believers to articulate for governments, media, and the general public in every part of the world the perspective in which the Baha'i faith pursues its work. Quote, "The unity of the human race, as envisioned by Baha'u'llah, implies the establishment of a world commonwealth in which all nations, races, creeds, and classes are closely and permanently united, and in which the autonomy of its state members and the personal freedom and initiative of the individuals that compose them are definitely and completely safeguarded. This commonwealth must, as far as we can visualize it, consist of a world legislature, whose members will, as the trustees of the whole of mankind, ultimately control the entire resources of all the component nations, and will enact such laws as shall be required to regulate the life, satisfy the needs, and adjust the relationships of all races and peoples. A world executive, backed by an international force, will carry out the decisions arrived at and apply the laws enacted by this world legislature, and will safeguard the organic unity of the whole commonwealth. A world tribunal will adjudicate and deliver its compulsory and final verdict in all and any disputes that may arise between the various elements constituting this universal system. The economic resources of the world will be organized, its sources of raw materials will be tapped and fully utilized, its markets will be coordinated and developed, and the distribution of its products will be equitably regulated." End quote. World Order Baha'u'llah, page 203-204. Writing a definitive interpretation of the administrative order in The Dispensation of Baha'u'llah, Shoghi Effendi made particular reference to the role of the institution he himself represented would play in enabling the cause to take a long and uninterrupted view over a series of generations. Page 52. This unique endowment expressed itself with particular clarity in his description of the dual nature of the historical process that he saw unfolding in the 20th century. "The landscape of international affairs would," he said, "be increasingly reshaped by twin forces of integration and disintegration, both of them ultimately beyond human control. In the light of what meets our eyes today, his previsioning of the operation of this dual process is breathtaking. The creation of a mechanism of world intercommunication, functioning with marvelous swiftness and perfect regularity." Shoghi Effendi, World Order Baha'u'llah, page 203. "The undermining of the nation-state as the chief arbitrator of human destiny, the devastating effects that advancing moral breakdown throughout the world would have on a social cohesion, the widespread public disillusionment produced by political corruption, and, unimaginable to others of his generation, the rise of global agencies dedicated to promoting human welfare, coordinating economic activity, defining international standards, and encouraging a sense of solidarity among diverse races and cultures. These and other developments," the Guardian explained, "would fundamentally alter the conditions in which the Baha'i cause would pursue its mission in the decades lying ahead." One of the striking developments of this kind that Shoghi Effendi discerned in the writings he was called on to interpret concerned the future role of the United States as a nation, and to a lesser extent its sister nations in the Western Hemisphere. His foresight is all the more remarkable when one remembers that he was writing during a period of history when the United States was determinedly isolationist in both its foreign policy and the convictions of a majority of its citizens. Shoghi Effendi, however, envisioned the country assuming an active and decisive part in the organization and the peaceful settlement of the affairs of mankind. He reminded Baha'is of Abu Baha's anticipation that because of the unique nature of its social composition and political development, as opposed to any inherent excellence or special merit of its people, The United States had developed capacities that could empower it to be the first nation, quote, the first nation to establish the foundation of international agreement, end quote. Indeed, he foresaw the governments and peoples of the entire hemisphere becoming increasingly oriented in this direction. Shoghi Effendi, The Advent of Divine Justice, pages 90, 19, and 85. Page 53. The role that the Baha'i community must play in helping bring about this consummation of the historical process had been prefigured in the summons addressed to his followers by the Bab at the very birth of the cause. Quote, "Oh, my beloved friends, you are the bearers of the name of God in this day. You are the lowly of whom God has thus spoken in his book. And when we desire to show favor to those who were brought low in the land, and to make them spiritual leaders among men, and to make them our heirs, you have been called to this station. You will attain to it only if you arise to trample beneath your feet every earthly desire and endeavor to become those honored servants of his who speak not till he hath spoken and who do his bidding. Heed not your weaknesses and frailty. Fix your gaze upon the invincible power of the Lord your God, the Almighty. Arise in his name, put your trust wholly in him, and be assured of ultimate victory." End quote. Nabil Yazam, The Dawnbreakers, Nabil's Narrative of the Early Days of the Baha'i Revelation, page 92-94. As early as 1923, Shoghi Effendi was moved to open his heart on this subject to the friends in North America. Quote, "Let us pray to God that in this days of world encircling gloom, when the dark forces of nature, of hate, rebellion, anarchy, and reaction, are threatening the very stability of human society, when the most precious fruits of civilization are undergoing severe and unparalleled tests, we may all realize more profoundly than ever that though but a mere handful amidst the seething masses of the world, we are in this day the chosen instruments of God's grace, that our mission is most urgent and vital to the fate of humanity, and fortified by these sentiments, arise to achieve God's holy purpose for mankind." End quote. Shoghi Effendi, Baha'i Administration, page 52. Fully aware of the condition into which society had fallen, the consequences of his betrayal at the hands of family members on whose assistance he should have been able to rely, and the relative weakness of the resources available to him in the Baha'i community itself, page 54, Shoghi Effendi arose to forge the means needed to realize the mission bequeathed to him. To one degree or another, most Baha'is no doubt appreciated that the assemblies they were being called on to form had a significance far beyond the mere management of practical affairs with which they were being charged. Abdu'l-Bahá, who had guided this development, had spoken of them as, quote, "shining lamps in heavenly gardens from which the fragrances of holiness are diffused over all regions, and the lights of knowledge are shed abroad over all created things. From them the spirit of life streameth in every direction. They indeed are the potent sources of the progress of man at all times and under all conditions." End quote. Selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, pages 85-86. It fell to Shoghi Effendi, however, to assist the community to understand the place and role of these national and local consultative bodies in the framework of the administrative order created by Baha'u'llah and elaborated in the provisions of the Master's Will and Testament. An obstacle faced by a significant number of believers in this respect was the unexamined assumption of many that the cause was essentially, quote, a spiritual, quote, association in which organization, while not necessarily antithetical, did not constitute an inherent feature of the divine purpose. Emphasizing that the Kitabi Akdas and the Will and Testament, quote, are not only complementary, but mutually confirm one another and are inseparable parts of one complete unit, end quote. The Guardian invited the believers to reflect deeply on the central truth of the cause they had embraced. Footnote on the quote, World Order Baha'u'llah, page 4. Quoting, Few will fail to recognize that the spirit breathed by Baha'u'llah upon the world, and which is manifesting itself with varying degrees of intensity through the efforts consciously displayed by his avowed supporters and indirectly through certain humanitarian organizations, can never permeate and exercise an abiding influence upon mankind unless and until it incarnates itself in a visible order which would bear his name, wholly identify itself with his principles, and function in conformity with his laws. End quote. Word Order Baha'u'llah, page 19. Page 55. He went on to urge the faith's followers to realize the essential difference between the cause of Baha'u'llah, whose revealed texts contain detailed provisions for such an authoritative order, and those preparatory revelations whose scriptures have been largely silent on the administration of affairs and on the interpretation of the founder's intent. In the words of Baha'u'llah, quote, "The prophetic cycle hath verily ended. The eternal truth is now come. He hath lifted up the ensign of power." End quote. Gleanings from the Writings of Baha'u'llah, page 60. Unlike the dispensations of the past, the revelation of God to this age has given birth, Shoghi Effendi said, to, quote, "a living organism," end quote, whose laws and institutions constitute the essentials of a divine economy, a pattern for future society, and the one agency for the unification of the world and the proclamation of the reign of righteousness and justice upon the earth. End of quotes. Shoghi Effendi, World Order Baha'u'llah, page 19. The French should strive to appreciate, therefore, the Guardian urged, that the spiritual assemblies they were painstakingly establishing throughout the world were the forerunners of the local and national houses of justice envisioned by Baha'u'llah. As such, they were integral parts of the administrative order that will, in time, quote, "assert its claim and demonstrate its capacity to be regarded not only as the nucleus but the very pattern of the new world order, destined to embrace in the fullness of time the whole of mankind." End of quote. World Order Baha'u'llah, page 19. For a few in the young communities of the West, such a departure from traditional conceptions of the nature and role of religion proved too great a test, and Baha'i communities suffered the distress of seeing valued co-workers drift away in search of spiritual pursuits more congenial to their inclinations. For the mass majority of believers, however, great messages from the Guardian's pen, such as the goal of a new world order and the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, threw brilliant light on precisely the issue that most concerned them, the relationship between spiritual truth and social development, inspiring in them a determination to play their part in laying the foundations of humanity's future. The Guardian provided, as well, the organizing image for this mighty work. The heroic age of Baha'u'llah's dispensation, he declared, had ended with the passing of Abu Baha. The Baha'i community now embarked on the Iron Age, the formative age, in which the administrative order would be erected throughout the planet, its institutions established as the society-building powers inherent in it fully revealed. Page 56. Far ahead lay what Shoghi Effendi called the golden age of the dispensation, leading eventually to the emergence of the Baha'i world commonwealth that will constitute the establishment on earth of the kingdom of God and creation of a world civilization. From God Passes By, page 26. The impulse that had been initially communicated to human consciousness through the revelation of the creative word itself, whose revolutionary social implications had been proclaimed by the Master, was now being translated by their appointed interpreter into the vocabulary of political and economic transformation in which the public discourse of the century was everywhere taking place. Lending the process irresistible force, illuminating ever new dimensions of Baha'i experience, and serving as the mainspring of the unification of humankind, it proclaimed, was the covenant that Baha'u'llah had established between himself and those who turned to him. Although not initially designated spiritual assemblies, the councils that local Baha'i communities in Persia had been encouraged by Abdul Baha to create had assumed responsibility for the administration of their affairs. In the light of what was to follow, No one with a sense of history can fail to be struck by the fact that the faith's first spiritual assembly, that of Tehran, was founded in 1897, the year of Shoghi Effendi's own birth. Under the master's guidance, intermittent meetings held by the Four Hands of the Cause in Persia had gradually evolved into this institution that serves simultaneously as Persia's central spiritual assembly and as the governing body of the local community and the capital. By the time of Abu Baha's passing, there were more than 30 local spiritual assemblies established in Persia. In 1922, Shoghi Effendi called for the formal establishment of Persia's National Spiritual Assembly, an achievement delayed until 1934 by the demands related to the taking of a reliable census of the community as the basis for the election of delegates. Outside Persia, the believers in Ashgabat in Russian Turkestan elected their first local spiritual assembly, a body that assumed an important role in the project for the construction of the first Baha'i Majka Ashkar in Ashgabat. In North America, a variety of consultative arrangements, boards of council, council boards of consultation, and working committees, performed analogous functions, evolving gradually into elected bodies that constituted the forerunners of spiritual assemblies. Page 57. By the time of the master's passing, there were perhaps 40 such councils functioning in North America. These developments prepared the way for the eventual emergence of the first National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of the United States and Canada, which evolved from the Temple Unity Board, a body created in 1909 to coordinate construction of the future House of Worship. It was formed in 1923, although the administrative requirements set by the Guardian for this step were met only in 1925. Before this latter date arrived, national assemblies had been established in the British Isles, in Germany and Austria, and in Egypt and the Sudan. Footnote, Baha'i World, Volume 10, pages 142-149, provides a detailed survey of the expansion of the cause up to the conclusion of the first seven-year plan. End of footnote. As the formation of national and local spiritual assemblies was taking place, the Guardian began to lay emphasis on the importance of their securing recognition as corporate persons under civil law. By securing such formal incorporation in whatever fashion proved practical, Baha'i administrative institutions would be enabled to hold property, enter into contracts, and gradually assume a range of legal rights vital to the interests of the cause. The importance Shoghi Effendi attached to this new stage of administrative evolution becomes clear in the photocopies of such civil instruments that began to become a major feature of the photographic coverage of the expansion of the faith in successive volumes of the Baha'i World. Indeed, once the mansion at Bhaji had been repossessed and fully restored to its original condition and appropriately furnished, Shoghi Effendi put together a collection of this much-valued documentation for display there as an encouragement and education for the growing stream of pilgrims to the World Center. The process of civil incorporation began with the adoption in 1927 of a Declaration of Trust and Bylaws for the National Spiritual Assembly of the United States and Canada, which gained civil recognition as a voluntary trust 2 years later. On 17 February 1932, the first local Baha'i Assembly, that of Chicago, adopted papers of incorporation, which, together with those adopted by that of New York City on 31 March of that year, were to become a pattern for such instruments throughout the world. By 1949, the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of Canada formed when the two North American Baha'i communities had separated the previous year, was able to secure formal recognition of its status under civil law through a special act of Parliament, a victory which Shoghi Effendi hailed as, quote, an act wholly unprecedented in the annals of the faith in any country in either East or West. That's from Messages Canada, 2nd edition, page 114. Page 58. These pressing administrative demands did not distract Shoghi Effendi from other tasks that were vital to shaping the spiritual life of a global community. The most important of these was the arduous work that he alone could perform in providing the growing body of the believers who were not of Persian background, with direct and reliable access to the writings of the faith's founders. The Hidden Words, the Katavyagan, the priceless treasury brought together with so much love and insight under the title Gleanings from the Writings of Baha'u'llah, Prayers and Meditations of Baha'u'llah, and Epistle to the Son of the Wolf, provided the spiritual nourishment the work of the cause urgently required, as did Shoghi Effendi's translation and editing of Nabil's narrative under the title The Dawnbreakers. Baha'i pilgrims found spiritual enrichment of yet another kind in the holy places and historic sites that the Guardian acquired, often at the cost of protracted and wrenching negotiations, and lovingly restored. Shoghi Effendi was equally responsive to the unexpected opportunities that offered themselves to his historical perspective. In 1925, a Sunni Muslim religious court in Egypt denied civil recognition to marriages contracted between Muslim women and Baha'i men, insisting that the Baha'i faith is a new religion entirely independent, and that no Baha'i therefore can be regarded a Muslim, and therefore qualified to enter into marriage with someone who was. Shoghi Effendi God Passes By, page 365. Seizing on the larger implications of this apparent defeat, the Guardian made wise use of the court's definitive judgment to reinforce the claim of the cause in international circles to be an independent faith, separate and distinct from its Islamic roots. As the Baha'i community was constructing administrative foundations which would permit it to play an effective role in human affairs, page 59, the accelerating process of disintegration that Shoghi Effendi had discerned was undermining the fabric of social order, its origins, however, determinedly ignored by many social and political theorists, are beginning, after the lapse of several decades, to gain recognition at international conferences devoted to peace and development. In our own time, it is no longer unusual to encounter in such circles candid references to the essential role that spiritual and moral forces must play in achieving solutions to urgent problems. For a Baha'i reader, such belated recognition awakens echoes of warning addressed over a century earlier by Baha'u'llah to the rulers of human affairs. Quote, "The vitality of men's belief in God is dying out in every land. The corrosion of ungodliness is eating into the vitals of human society." End quote. Gleanings from the Writings of Baha'u'llah, page 200. The responsibility for this greatest of tragedies, the Guardian emphasized, rests primarily on the shoulders of the world's religious leaders. Baha'u'llah's severest condemnation is reserved for those who, presuming to speak in God's name, have imposed on credulous masses a welter of dogmas and prejudices that have constituted the greatest single obstacle against which the advancement of civilization has been forced to struggle. While acknowledging the humanitarian services of countless individual clerics, he points out the consequences of the way in which self-appointed religious elites throughout history have interposed themselves between humanity and all voices of progress, not excluding the messengers of God themselves. Quote, "What oppression is more grievous," he asks, "than that a soul seeking the truth and wishing to attain unto the knowledge of God should not know where to go for it?" End quote. Shoghi Effendi God Passes By, page 365. In an age of scientific advancement and widespread popular education, the cumulative effects of the resulting disillusionment were to make religious faith appear irrelevant. Impotent themselves to deal with the spiritual crisis, most of those clerics of various faiths who had become aware of Baha'u'llah's message either ignored the moral influence it was demonstrating or actively opposed it. Footnote. In Europe at the start of the 20th century, most people accepted the authority of morality. Then, reflective Europeans were also able to believe in moral progress and to see human viciousness and barbarianism as in retreat. At the end of the century, it is hard to be confident either about the moral law or about moral progress. Jonathan Glover, Humanity, A Moral History of the 20th Century, page 1. Glover's study concentrates particularly on the rise and influence of 20th century ideologies. End of footnote. Recognition of this feature of history does not diminish the harm done by those who have sought to take advantage of the spiritual vacuum thus left. The yearning for belief is inextinguishable, an inherent part of what makes one human. When it is blocked or betrayed, the rational soul is driven to seek some new compass point, however inadequate or unworthy, around which it can organize experience and dare again to assume the risks that are in an inescapable aspect of life. Page 60. It was in this perspective that Shoghi Effendi warned the members of the faith, in unusually strong language, that they must try to understand the spiritual calamity engulfing a large part of humankind during the decades between the two world wars. Quote, God himself has indeed been dethroned from the hearts of men, and an idolatrous world passionately and clamorously hails and worships the false gods which its own idle fancies have fortuitously created, and its misguided hands so impiously exalted. Their high priests are the politicians and the worldly wise, the so-called sages of the age. Their sacrifice, the flesh and blood of the slaughtered multitudes. Their incantations, outworn shibboleths, and insidious and irreverent formulas. Their incense, the smoke of anguish that ascends from the lacerated hearts of the bereaved, the maimed, and the homeless. End quote. Shoghi Effendi, The Promised Day Has Come, page 185-186. Like opportunist infections, aggressive ideologies took advantage of the situation created by the decline of religious vitality. Although indistinguishable from one another in the corruption of faith they represented, the three belief systems that played a dominant role in human affairs during the 20th century differed sharply in their secondary and more conspicuous characteristics to which the Guardian drew attention. In denouncing the dark, the false, and crooked doctrines that would bring devastation on any man or people who believes in them, Shoghi Effendi warned particularly against the triple gods of nationalism, racialism, and communism. The Promised Day Has Come, page 185-186. Of fascism's founding regime, created by the so-called March on Rome in 1922, little need be said. Long before it and its leaders had been swept into oblivion during the concluding months of the Second World War, fascism had become an object of ridicule among the majority of even those who had originally supported it. Its significance lies, rather, in the host of imitators it spawned, and which were to proliferate throughout the world like some malignant series of mutations in the decades since then. Fueled by a manic nationalism, this aberration of the human spirit deified the state, discovered everywhere imaginary threats to the national survival of whatever unhappy people it had fastened upon, and preached to all who would listen the notion that war has an ennobling influence on the human soul. Page 61. The comic opera parade of uniforms, jackboots, banners, and trumpets usually associated with it should not conceal from a contemporary observer the virulent legacy it has left in our own age, enshrining in political vocabulary such anguished terms as despotados, the disappeared. While sharing fascism's idolatry of the state, its sister ideology, Nazism, made itself the voice of a far more ancient and insidious perversion. At its dark heart was an obsession with what its proponents called race purity. The single-minded determination with which it pursued its murderous ends was in no way weakened by the demonstrably false postulates upon which it was based. The Nazi system was unique in the sheer bestiality of the act most commonly associated with its name, the program of genocide systematically carried out against populations considered either valueless or harmful to humanity's future, a program that included a deliberate attempt, literally, to exterminate the entire Jewish people. Ultimately, it was Nazism's determination that a master race of its own conception must rule over the entire planet, which was principally responsible for fulfilling Abdu'l-Bahá's prophetic warning of 20 years earlier that another war, far more terrible than the first, would ravage the world. Like fascism, Nazism has left a detritus in our own time. In its case, This takes the form of a language and symbols through which fringe elements in present-day society, demoralized by the economic and social decay around them, and made desperate by the absence of solutions, vent their impotent rage on minorities whom they blame for their disappointments. The false god that the master was moved to identify explicitly, and the one denounced by name by Shoghi Effendi, had demonstrated its character at its outset by brutally destroying, during the latter part of World War I, the first democratic government ever established in Russia. For long years, the Soviet system created by Vladimir Lenin succeeded in representing itself to many as a benefactor of humankind and the champion of social justice. In the light of historical events, such pretensions were grotesque. Page 62. The documentation now available provides irrefutable evidence of crimes so enormous and follies so abysmal as to have no parallel in the 6,000 years of recorded history. To a degree never before imagined, let alone attempted, the Leninist conspiracy against human nature also sought systematically to extinguish faith in God. Whatever view of the situation political theorists may currently hold, no one can be surprised that such deliberate violence to the roots of human motivation led inexorably to the economic and political ruin of those societies luckless enough to fall under Soviet sway. Its longer-term spiritual effect, tragically, was to pervert to the service of its own amoral agenda the legitimate yearnings for freedom and justice of subject peoples throughout the world. From a Baha'i point of view, humanity's worship of idols of its own invention is of importance not because of the historical events associated with those forces, however horrifying, but because of the lesson it taught. Looking back on the twilight world in which such diabolical forces loomed over humanity's future, one must ask, what was the weakness in human nature that rendered it vulnerable to such influences? To have seen in someone like Benito Mussolini the figure of a man of destiny, to have felt obliged to understand the racial theories of Adolf Hitler as anything other than the self-evident products of a diseased mind, to have seriously entertained the reinterpretation of human experience through dogmas that had given birth to the Soviet Union of Joseph Lenin, Stalin, so willful an abandonment of reason on the part of a considerable segment of the intellectual leadership of society demands an accounting to posterity. If undertaken dispassionately, such an evaluation must, sooner or later, focus attention on a truth that runs like a central strand through the scriptures of all of humanity's religions. In the words of Baha'u'llah, quote, "Upon the reality of man, he hath focused the radiance of all his names and attributes and made it a mirror of his own self. These energies lie, however, latent within him, even as the flame is hidden within the candle and the rays of light are potentially present in the lamp. Neither the candle nor the lamp can be lighted through their own unaided efforts, nor can it ever be possible for the mirror to free itself from its dross." Page 63. The reference is from Gleanings from Writings of Baha'u'llah, page 65 through 66. The consequence of humanity's infatuation with the ideologies its own mind had conceived was to produce a terrifying acceleration of the process of disintegration that was dissolving the fabric of social life and cultivating the basest impulses of human nature. The brutalization that the First World War had engendered now became an omnipresent feature of social life throughout much of the planet. Quote, "Thus have we gathered together the workers of iniquity," Baha'u'llah warned over a century earlier. "We see them rushing on towards their idol. They hasten forward to hell fire and mistake it for light." End quote. Gleanings, page 41 through 42. 63, page 65, chapter 6. With the administrative structure of the cause taking shape, Shoghi Effendi turned his attention to the task he had been compelled to delay for so long, the implementation of the Master's divine plan. In Persia, the development was already well advanced. directed first by Baha'u'llah and subsequently by Abdu'l-Bahá, a corps of especially designated teachers, Mubaligheen, stimulated the work at the local level throughout the country, and the existence of a vibrant community life assisted in the relatively rapid integration of a new declarant. Hukukla funds, supplemented by the practice of deputization, which was already an established feature of Persian Baha'i consciousness, provided material support for this teaching activity. In the West, inspiration for the promotion of the faith had been provided by the response to the Master's appeals by such outstanding individuals as Lua Gesinger, Mae Maxwell, and Martha Root. Merely to mention these names is to highlight a feature of the rise of the cause in the West to which the Master drew particular attention. Quote, "In America, the women have outdone the men in this regard and have taken the lead in this field. They strive harder in guiding the prophet peoples of the world, and their endeavors are great." Page 66. "They are confirmed by divine bestowals and blessings." That's from Women, Extracts from the Writings of Baha'u'llah, Shoghi Effendi, and the Universal House of Justice, page 50. In the East, social conditions of the time had virtually dictated that the initiative in the promotion of the cause would be taken largely by men. Few such constraints prevailed in North America and Europe, where a galaxy of unforgettable women became the principal exponents of the Baha'i message on both sides of the Atlantic. One thinks of Sarah Farmer, whose Greenacre School provided the infant Baha'i community with a forum for the introduction of the faith to influential thinkers. Of Sarah Lady Bloomfield, whose social position lent added force to the ardor with which she championed the teachings. Of Marion Jack, immortalized by Shoghi Effendi as a model for Baha'i pioneers. Of Laura Dreyfus Barney, who gave the faith a priceless collection of the Master's Table Talks, Some Answered Questions. Of Agnes Parsons, co-founder with Lewis Gregory of the Race Amity initiatives inspired by Abdu'l-Bahá. Of Corinne True, Keith Ransom Keller, Helen Goodall, Juliet Thompson, Grace Ober, Ethel Rosenberg, Clara Dunn, Alma Knobloch, and a distinguished company of others, most of whom pioneered some new field of Baha'i service. To the list must be added the name of Queen Maria of Romania, whom the ages will hail as the first crowned head to recognize the revelation of God for this day. The courage shown by this lone woman in publicly declaring her faith through the letters she fearlessly addressed to the editors of several newspapers in both Europe and North America, in all probability, introduced the name of the cause to an audience numbering millions of readers. Despite the impressive response that the earliest of these efforts solicited, the lack of an organized means of capitalizing on the results initially limited the benefits accruing to Baha'i communities in Western lands. The rise of the administrative order dramatically changed the latter situation. As local spiritual assemblies came into being, goals were set, resources were made available to support individual teaching efforts, and those who declared their faith found themselves participating in the many activities of an engrossing Baha'i community life. It was now possible to systematically translate and publish literature, news of general interest was regularly shared, and the bonds that linked believers with the world center of the faith grew steadily stronger. Page 67. The two chief instruments by which Shoghi Effendi set about cultivating a heightened devotion to teaching in both East and West were the same as those on which the Master had relied. A steady stream of letters to communities and individuals alike opened up for the recipients new dimensions in the beliefs that they had embraced. The most important of these communications, however, now became those addressed to national and local spiritual assemblies. Their effect was intensified by the stream of returning pilgrims who shared insights gained by direct contact with the center of the cause. Through these connections, every individual believer was encouraged to see himself or herself as an instrument of the power flowing through the covenant. The invaluable compilations that eventually appeared under the title Messages to America, 1932-1946, provides a review of the steps by which Shoghi Effendi drew the North American believers ever deeper into the implications of the Master's divine plan for the spiritual conquest of the planet. By this, quote, "by the sublimity and serenity of their faith, by the steadiness and clarity of their vision, the incorruptibility of their character, the rigor of their discipline, the sanctity of their morals, and the unique example of their community life, they can and indeed must, in a world polluted with its incurable corruptions, paralyzed by its haunting fears, torn by its devastating hatreds, and languishing under the weight of its appalling miseries, demonstrate the vitality of their validity of their claim to be regarded as the sole repository of that grace upon whose operation must depend the complete deliverance, the fundamental reorganization, and the supreme felicity of all mankind. End quote. Shirgefendi Messages to America, page 28. The Guardian held up before the eyes of the North American Baha'i community a vision of their spiritual destiny. Its members were, he said, quote, the spiritual descendants of the heroes of God's cause. Their rising and their rising institutions were, quote, the visible symbols of its, the faith's, undoubted sovereignty. The teachers and pioneers it sent out were torchbearers of an as yet unborn civilization. It was their collective challenge to assume a preponderating share in laying the foundations of the world order, which the Bab has heralded, which the mind of Baha'u'llah has envisioned, and whose features Baha'u'llah Abdul Baha, its architect, has delineated. Messages to America, pages 9, 10, 14, and 22. Page 68. The language of the messages is magnificent and thrilling. In acknowledging the darkness that widespread godlessness, violence, and creeping immorality was engendering, Shoghi Effendi described the role that Baha'is everywhere must play as instruments of the transforming power of the new revelation. Quote, theirs is the duty to hold aloft and undimmed the torch of divine guidance as the shades of night descend upon and ultimately envelop the entire human race. Theirs is the function, amidst its tumults, perils, and agonies, to witness to the vision and proclaim the approach of that recreated society, that Christ-promised kingdom, that world order whose generative impulse is the spirit of none other than Baha'u'llah himself, whose dominion is the entire planet, whose watchword is unity, whose animating power is the force of justice, whose directive purpose is the reign of righteousness and truth, and whose supreme glory is the complete, the undisturbed and everlasting felicity of the whole of humankind. That's Messages to America, page 28. In 1936, the Guardian judged that the administrative structure of the cause was sufficiently broad and consolidated in North America that he could begin the first stage of the implementation of the divine plan itself. With the world sliding into another global conflagration, and the scope possible to the efforts of the Persian believers being severely limited, the focus would necessarily have to be on the expansion and consolidation of the Baha'i community in the Western Hemisphere in preparation for the much larger undertakings that lay ahead. Calling on the plan's appointed executors, the believers in North America, the Guardian laid out a 7-year plan, scheduled to run from 1937 to 1944. Its objectives were to establish at least one local spiritual assembly in every state of the United States and every province of Canada, and to open to the cause 14 republics in Latin America. To these objectives were added the task, immensely demanding of a community with still very limited numbers and severely straitened financial resources, of completing the exterior ornamentation on the Mother Temple of the West.
This is the end of Side 2, Tape 2. Please stop the tape and continue on Tape 3.